you if you need to retire to consider your verdict. A man seated at the right-hand end of the front row, as befits a bit part player, stood up and, sticking to his script, said,
No, Comrade Chairman.
Have you reached a verdict?
Yes, we have, Comrade Chairman.
And is that verdict unanimous?
Yes, it is, Comrade Chairman.
And what is your verdict?
Each of the 12 members of the jury picked up a piece of paper from their chair and held it high in the air, revealing the word guilty. Harry wanted to point out that there was only one piece of paper on each chair, but as Anatoly had advised, he looked suitably chastened when the comrade chairman turned to face him for the first time.
The jury, she declared, has unanimously found you guilty of a premeditated crime against the state, and I therefore have no hesitation in sentencing you to 12 years imprisonment in a labor camp, where you can once again share a cell with your criminal friend Babakov.
She closed her file and paused for some considerable time before adding,
However, as Colonel Marinkin recommended, I will offer you one last chance to sign a confession admitting your crime and the terrible mistake you have made. Should you do so, your sentence will be suspended, and you will be extradited and never allowed to visit the Soviet Union or any of its satellites again. Should you ever attempt to do so, your sentence will automatically be reinstated.
After a short pause, she said,
Are you willing to sign a confession?
Harry bowed his head and said, very quietly,
Yes, I am.
For the first time, all three judges showed an emotion, surprise. The chairman couldn't hide her relief, unintentionally revealing what her masters had clearly always wanted.
Then you may approach the dais, she said.
Harry stood up and walked over to the three judges. He was shown two copies of the confession, one in Russian and the other in English, both of which he read carefully.
You will now read your confession to the court.
Harry read the Russian version first, which brought a smile to the lips of the comrade chairman. He then picked up the English version and started to recite it. From the blank stares he received, he wondered if anyone in that courtroom understood a word of English. He decided to take a risk, change the occasional word, and see how they reacted.
I, Harry Clifton, a citizen of the United Kingdom and president of Penn, have involuntarily and with coercion signed this confusion. I have spent the past 3 years with Anatoly Babakov, who has made it clear to me that he did work in the Kremlin, and met Comrade Chairman Stalin on several occasions, including when he was awarded his degree. Babakov also admitted that the book he wrote about Comrade Stalin was fact and not a figment of his imagination. I shall continue to demand Babakov's release from prison, now that I am aware of the lengths this court went to in order to deceive the public with this fraud. I am most grateful to the court for its lethargy on this occasion, and for allowing me to return to my own country.
The chairman handed him a pen, and he was just about to sign both copies when he decided to take a second risk.
Members of the jury, said Mrs. Justice Lane, it now falls to me to sum up what has been a complex case. Some facts are not in dispute. Mrs. Clifton does not deny that when addressing a packed annual general meeting of her family company, she made the following reply to a question from Lady Virginia Fenwick, and later had it recorded in the minutes of the meeting. If it was your intention to bring the company down, Lady Virginia, then you have failed, and failed lamentably, because you were defeated by decent, ordinary people who want this company to be a success. The defendant, Mrs. Clifton, has testified that she believes her words were justified,
while the plaintiff, Lady Virginia, claims they are libelous. Whether they are or not is what this trial is about, and the final decision is yours. Your biggest challenge, may I suggest, is to make a judgment about the two women involved in this case. You have seen them both in the witness box, and I suspect you will have formed your own opinion as to which you consider the more credible. Do not allow yourselves to be influenced by the fact that Mrs. Clifton is the chairman of a public company, and therefore should be given some leeway when answering a question from someone she considers hostile. What you must decide is whether she libelled Lady Virginia or did not. Equally, you should not be overawed by the fact that Lady Virginia is the daughter of an earl. You must treat her no differently than you would your next-door neighbour. When you retire to the jury room to consider your verdict, take your time. I am in no hurry. And do not forget that the decision you are about to make will affect both of these women for the rest of their lives. But first, you must select a foreman who will act as chairman. When you've reached your verdict, please tell the jury bailiff that you wish to come back into court so that I can inform all those directly and indirectly involved in this case to return to hear your decision. I shall now ask the jury bailiff to escort you to the jury room so you can begin your deliberations. A tall, elegantly dressed man with a military bearing and wearing what looked like a schoolmaster's gown stepped forward and led the seven men and five women of the jury out of the courtroom. Moments later, the judge rose from her place, bowed to the court, and returned to her chambers.
"What did you make of the summing up?"
asked Emma.
"Measured and fair,"
Mr. Trelford assured her.
"You have nothing to complain about."
"And how long do you think it would take them to reach a decision?"
Giles asked.
"It's impossible to predict. If they are all in agreement, which I think is highly unlikely, no more than a couple of hours. If they are divided, it could be a couple of days."
"Can I read the letter Major Fisher sent you?"
asked Sebastian innocently.
"No, you cannot, Mr. Clifton,"
said Trelford, pushing the envelope further down into his inside pocket.
"And nor can anyone else, unless and until Mrs. Justice Lane allows me to reveal its contents. I cannot and will not go against the express wishes of the judge."
"Good try, though," he said, grinning at Seb.
"How long are we expected to hang about?"
asked Virginia, who was sitting with her counsel on the other side of the courtroom.
"I've no idea," said Sir Edward. "If I were to hazard a guess, I'd say a day, possibly two."
"And why did Major Fisher address his last letter to Trelford, and not to you?"
"That I haven't been able to work out. But I confess I'm puzzled why Trelford didn't press the judge more strongly to be allowed to read the letter to the jury, if it was at all likely to benefit his client."
"Perhaps he was bluffing."
"Or double bluffing."
"Am I safe to take a couple of hours off?"
asked Virginia.
"There's something I need to do."
"Why not? I can't see the jury returning before this afternoon."
Chapter 45. Harry hadn't expected a chauffeur-driven car to take him to the airport, and he was even more surprised when he saw who the chauffeur was.
"I just want to make sure you get on the plane," said Colonel Marinkin.
"How very considerate of you, Colonel,"
said Harry, forgetting to remain in character.
"Don't get clever with me, Mr. Clifton. The railway station is closer than the airport, and it's not too late for you to join Babakov on a journey that won't have a return ticket for another 12 years.
"But I signed the confession,"
said Harry, trying to sound conciliatory.
"Which I know you'll be glad to hear has already been released to every leading newspaper in the West, from the New York Times to the Guardian. It will have hit most of their front pages before you touch down at Heathrow. So even if you did try to deny it..."
"I can assure you, Colonel, that Unlike St. Peter, there will be no need for me to deny anything. I saw Babakov for what he was. And in any case, an Englishman's word is his bond.
I'm glad to hear that, said the colonel, as he accelerated onto the motorway and put his foot hard down. Within seconds, the indicator was touching 100 miles an hour. Harry clung on to the dashboard as the colonel nipped in and out of the traffic. And for the first time since he'd set foot in Russia, Harry was genuinely frightened. As they passed the Hermitage, the colonel couldn't resist asking,
Have you ever visited the Hermitage, Mr. Clifton?
No, said Harry, but I've always wanted to.
Pity, because now you never will,
said the colonel as he overtook a couple of lorries. Harry only began to relax when the airport terminal came into sight, and the colonel slowed to 60. He hoped his plane would take off before the first editions hit the streets. Otherwise, he might still be on that train to Siberia, and as he couldn't hope to get through customs for at least a couple of hours, it might be a close-run thing. Suddenly, the car swung off the road, through a gate held open by two guards, and drove onto a runway. The colonel dodged in and out of the stationary aircraft with much the same abandon with which he had treated the cars on the motorway. He screeched to a halt at the bottom of an aircraft steps, where two guards, who had clearly been waiting for him, sprang to attention and saluted even before he got out of the car. Marinkin leapt out, and Harry followed him.
Don't let me hold you up, said the colonel. Just be sure you'll never come back. Because if you do, I'll be at the bottom of the steps, waiting for you.
They didn't shake hands. Harry walked up the staircase as quickly as he could, knowing he wouldn't feel safe until the plane had taken off. When he reached the top step, the senior steward came forward and said,
Welcome aboard, Mr. Clifton. Let me take you to your seat.
Clearly, he was expected. The steward guided him to the back row of first class, and Harry was relieved to find the seat next to him was empty. No sooner had he sat down than the aircraft door was slammed shut and the seatbelt sign switched on. He still wasn't quite ready to breathe a sigh of relief.
Is there anything I can get you once we've taken off, Mr. Clifton?
Asked the steward.
How long is the flight? 5.5 hours, including a stopover in Stockholm. A strong black coffee, no sugar, 2 pens, and as much writing paper as you can spare. And could you let me know the moment we're no longer in Russian airspace?
Of course, sir, said the steward, as if he got this sort of request every day. Harry closed his eyes and tried to concentrate as the plane began to taxi to the far end of the runway in preparation for takeoff. Anatoly had explained to him that he knew the book off by heart and had spent the past 16 years repeating it to himself again and again in the hope that one day he would be released, when it could be published. As soon as the seatbelt sign had been switched off, the steward returned and handed Harry 12 sheets of BOAC writing paper and 2 ballpoint pens.
I'm afraid that won't be enough for the first chapter, said Harry. Can you keep up a regular supply?
I'll do my best, said the steward. And will you be hoping to catch a couple of hours' sleep during the flight?
Not if I can possibly avoid it.
Then may I suggest you leave your reading light on, so when the cabin lights are dimmed, you can go on working?
Thank you.
Would you like to see the first-class menu, sir?
Only if I can write on the back of it.
A cocktail, perhaps?
No, I'll stick with the coffee, thank you. And can I say something that's going to sound incredibly rude, but I assure you it's not meant to be?
Of course, sir.
Could you not speak to me again until we land in Stockholm?
As you wish, sir.
Other than to tell me when we're no longer in Russian airspace.
The senior steward nodded.
Thank you, said Harry.
Then picked up a pen and began writing. I first met Joseph Stalin when I graduated from the Foreign Languages Institute in 1941. I was on a conveyor belt of graduates being awarded their degrees. And if you had told me then that I would spend the next 13 years working for a monster who made Hitler look like a pacifist, I would not have believed it possible. But I have only myself to blame, because I would never have been offered a job in the Kremlin if I hadn't come top of my class and been awarded the Lenin Medal. If I'd come second, I would have joined my wife, Yelena, taught English in a state school, and not been even a footnote in history. Harry paused as he tried to recall a paragraph that began, "For the first 6 months." For the first 6 months, I worked in a small office in one of the many outer buildings within the red wall that encircled the 69 acres of the Kremlin. My job was to translate the leader's speeches from Russian into English without any idea if anyone ever read them. But then one day, two members of the secret police, NKVD, appeared by my desk and ordered me to accompany them. I was led out of the building, across a courtyard, and into the Senate, a building I'd never entered before. I must have been searched a dozen times before I was allowed to enter a large office where I found myself in the presence of Comrade Stalin, the General Secretary of the party. I towered above him, although I am only 5'9", but what I remember most was those yellow eyes boring into mine. I hoped he couldn't see that I was shaking. I learned years later that he became suspicious of any state employee who wasn't shaking when they first appeared before him. Why did he want to see me? Clement Attlee had just been elected as the British Prime Minister, and Stalin wanted to know how it could be possible for such an insignificant little man, Attlee was an inch taller than Stalin, to replace Winston Churchill, whom he admired and respected. After I'd explained the vagaries of the British electoral system to him, all he said was, "That's the ultimate proof that democracy doesn't work." A steaming hot coffee, Harry's second, and more sheets of paper of different sizes and shapes were supplied by the silent chief steward. Sebastian took a cab to the High Court shortly after 11. Just as he had been about to leave his office, Rachel had dropped the Morning Post and three more thick files on his desk. He tried to tell himself that things would return to normal next week. He couldn't put off much longer telling Ross Buchanan that he intended to go to America and find out if he had the slightest chance of winning Samantha back, although he wasn't even sure she would agree to see him. Ross had met Samantha on the Buckingham's maiden voyage and later described her as the best asset he'd ever let go. "I didn't let her go," Seb had tried to explain. "And if I could get her back, I would, whatever the cost." As the taxi made its way through the morning traffic, he kept checking his watch, hoping he'd get there before the jury returned. He was paying the cabbie when he spotted Virginia. He froze on the spot. Even with her back to him, it couldn't have been anyone else. That confident air of generations past, the style, the class, would have made her stand out in any crowd. But what was she doing hiding away in a back alley talking to Desmond Mellor, of all people? Seb didn't even realize they knew each other. But why wasn't he surprised? He would immediately tell Uncle Giles and leave it for him to decide if they should let Emma know. Perhaps not until after the trial was over. He slipstreamed in among a tide of pedestrians to make sure neither of them spotted him. As he entered the Royal Courts of Justice, he ran up the wide staircase, dodging in and out of bewigged barristers as well as witnesses and defendants who wished they weren't there, until at last he reached the lobby outside Court 14.
"Over here, Seb," called a voice.
Seb looked around to see Giles and his mother sitting in the corner of the lobby chatting to Mr. Trelford, killing time. He strode across to join them. Giles told him there was no sign of the jury returning. He waited for his mother to resume her conversation with Mr. Trelford before he took Giles aside and told him what he just witnessed.
"Cedric Hardcastle taught me not to believe in coincidences," he concluded. "Particularly when Virginia is involved. With her, everything is planned to the finest detail. However, I don't think this is the time to tell your mother."
"But how could those two possibly know each other?"
"Alex Fisher has to be the common factor," said Giles. "But what worries me is that Desmond Mellor is a far more dangerous and clever man than Fisher ever was. I've never understood why he resigned from Barrington's so soon after he became deputy chairman.
I'm responsible for that, said Seb, and explained the deal he'd made with Hakim Bishara.
Clever, but be warned, Meller isn't the type to forgive or forget.
Would all those involved in the case of Fenwick versus Clifton please go to court number 14, as the jury is expected to return in the next few minutes.
The four of them rose as one and made their way quickly back into the courtroom, where they found the judge already seated in her place. Everyone was looking towards the door through which the jury would make their entrance, like theatergoers waiting for the curtain to rise. When the door finally opened, the chattering ceased, as the jury bailiff led his 12 charges back into court, then stood aside to allow them to return to their places in the jury box. Once they were settled, he asked the foreman to rise. The chosen one couldn't have appeared at first glance to be a less likely leader, even of this disparate group. He must have been around 60 and not an inch over 5'4", bald and wearing a three-piece suit, white shirt, and a striped tie that Giles guessed represented his club or his old school. You would have passed him in the street without giving him a first look. But the moment he opened his mouth, everyone understood why he had been selected. He spoke with a quiet authority, and Giles wouldn't have been surprised to learn that he was a solicitor, a schoolmaster, or even a senior civil servant.
Mr. Foreman, the judge said, leaning forward, have you reached a verdict on which you are all agreed?
No, my lady, he replied in a calm, measured voice. But I felt we ought to inform you of the impasse we have reached, in the hope you might advise us what we should do next.
I will certainly try,
said Mrs. Justice Lane, as if she was dealing with a trusted colleague.
We have taken the vote a number of times, and on each occasion it has resulted in an 8-4 deadlock. We were not certain if there was any purpose in us continuing.
I wouldn't want you to give up at this early stage, said the judge. Considerable time, effort, and expense has been invested in this trial, and the least any of us can do is to be absolutely sure we have made every effort to reach a verdict. If you think it might help, I will be willing to accept a majority verdict of 10-2, but nothing less will be acceptable.
Then we will try again, my lady, said the foreman,
and without another word, he led his little band back out of the court, with the bailiff bringing up the rear of an exclusive club that no one else would be invited to join. Once the door had closed behind them, a babble of chattering broke out, even before the judge had made her exit.
Who got 8 and who's got 4?
Was Virginia's first question.
You have the 8, said Edward, and I can identify almost every one of them.
How can you be so sure?
2 reasons. While the foreman was speaking to the judge, I kept my eyes on the jury, and the majority of them were looking at you. Juries, in my experience, don't look at the loser.
And the other reason?
Take a look at Trelford, and you'll see an unhappy man, because he will have carried out the same exercise.
Who got the majority? Asked Giles.
Never easy to try to second-guess a jury, said Trelford,
touching the envelope in his inside pocket, although he was fairly sure it wasn't his client who needed the extra 2 votes to win the action. So perhaps the time had come to allow Mrs. Clifton to see the Major's letter and decide if she wanted it read out in court. He would advise her to do so if she still hoped to win the case, but having come to know the lady over the past few months, he would not have been surprised if she thought otherwise. While Stalin was serving his first prison sentence in 1902 at the age of 23, like many ambitious party members, he decided to learn German so he could read Karl Marx in the original. But he only ended up with a cursory knowledge of the language. During his time in jail, he formed a self-appointed political committee of murderers and thugs who ruled over the other prisoners. Anyone who disobeyed him was beaten into submission. Soon, even the guards became intimidated by him and were probably relieved when he escaped. He once told me that he'd never murdered anyone, possibly true, because he only had to hint, drop a name, and that person was never heard of again. The most damning thing I learned about Stalin during my time at the Kremlin, and never repeated, even to my wife, for fear it would compromise her, was that when he was a young man and had been exiled to Kunyeka in Siberia, he fathered two children by a 13-year-old schoolgirl, Lydia Perepligina. And once he left Kunyeka, he not only never returned, but never contacted them again. Harry unfastened his seatbelt and walked up and down the length of the cabin as he thought about the next chapter. He began writing again the moment he returned to his seat. Another incident that Stalin regularly regaled us with was his claim that he carried out a series of bank robberies all over the country to raise funds for Lenin in support of the revolution. This certainly accounted for his rapid promotion, although Stalin yearned to be a politician and not simply thought of as a Caucasian bandit. When Stalin told his friend, Comrade Leonov, of his ambitions, he just smiled and said, "You can't carry out a revolution wearing silk gloves." Stalin nodded to one of his thugs, who followed Leonov out of the room. Leonov was never seen again.
"We are no longer in Russian airspace, Mr. Clifton," said the steward.
"Thank you," said Harry.
Stalin's arrogance and insecurity reached the most farcical proportions when the great motion picture director, Sergei Eisenstein, was chosen to make a film called October, to be shown at the Bolshoi Theatre to mark the 10th anniversary of the October Revolution. Stalin turned up the day before the first screening, and after seeing the film, ordered Eisenstein to remove any reference to Trotsky, the man acknowledged by the Bolshevik Party as the genius behind the October coup, but now regarded by Stalin as his most dangerous rival. When the film was screened for the general public the following day, there was no mention of Trotsky from beginning to end, because he'd been consigned to the cutting room floor. Pravda described the film as a masterpiece and made no mention of the missing Trotsky. The paper's previous editor, Sergei Paresky, was among those who had disappeared overnight for criticizing Stalin.
"We've run out of paper," said the steward.
"How far are we from Stockholm?"
asked Harry.
"About another hour, sir." He hesitated. "I have one other source you might consider."
"I'll consider anything rather than lose an hour."
"We have two varieties," said the steward, "first class or economy. But I think economy will serve your purpose better, a heavier texture and less absorbent."
Both of them giggled like schoolboys as the steward produced a roll in one hand and a box in the other. Harry took his advice and chose economy.
"By the way, sir, I love your books."
"This isn't my book," said Harry, as he continued writing.
Another persistent rumour his enemies spread was that during his youth, Stalin was a double agent, working for the Tsar's secret police at the same time as being one of Lenin's most trusted lieutenants. When Stalin's enemies found out about his regular meetings with the Tsar's secret police, he simply claimed he was turning them into double agents so they could work for the revolutionaries. And whenever anyone reported him, they mysteriously disappeared soon afterwards. So no one could ever be sure which side Stalin was working for. One cynic suggested whichever side looked like winning. Someone else who was never seen or heard of again. Harry paused as he tried to remember the opening line of the next chapter. "By now you will be asking yourself if I feared for my own life. No, because I was like wallpaper. I simply blended into the background, so no one ever noticed me. Very few of Stalin's inner circle even knew my name. No one ever sought my opinion on anything, let alone my support. I was an apparatchik, a junior civil servant of no significance, and had I been replaced by a different coloured wallpaper, I would have been forgotten within the hour. I had been working at the Kremlin for just over a year when I first thought about writing a memoir of the man no one spoke of unless it was in reverential tones, even behind his back. but it was another year before I summoned up the courage to write the first page. 3 years later, as my confidence grew, whenever I returned to my little flat each evening, I would write a page, perhaps two, about what had taken place that day. And before going to bed, like an actor, I would learn the newly minted script off by heart, and then destroy it. So frightened was I of being caught that Yelena would sit by the window whenever I was writing, just in case anyone paid an unexpected visit. If that had happened, I was ready to throw the page I was working on into the fire. But no one ever did visit, because no one considered me a threat to anything or anybody.
"Please fasten your seatbelts, as we will be landing in Stockholm in a few minutes' time."
"Can I stay on the plane?" asked Harry. "I'm afraid not, sir, but we have a first-class lounge where they serve breakfast, and where I'm sure you'll find an endless supply of paper."
Harry was the first off the plane, and within minutes had settled down at a table in the first-class lounge with a black coffee, several varieties of biscuits, and reams of typing paper. He must have been the only passenger who was delighted to learn that the flight had been delayed because of a mechanical fault. Yakov Bulgukov, the mayor of Romanovskaya, faced a potentially dangerous situation when he decided to build a massive image of Stalin, twice life-size, using convicts from a nearby prison to build the statue, which will be erected on the banks of the Volga-Don Canal. The mayor was horrified when he turned up for work each morning to find his leader's head covered in bird droppings. Bulgukov came up with a drastic solution. He ordered that a constant electric current should be run through the statue's head. A junior official was given the job of removing the little corpses every morning before the sun rose. Harry gathered his thoughts before he began the fourth chapter. Stalin had a hand-picked cadre of security guards led by General Nikolai Sidorovich Vlasik, whom he trusted with his life. He needed to, because he'd made so many enemies during the purges, when he'd eliminated anyone and everyone he considered to be a possible rival, at that time or in the future. I lost count of how many people were in favor one day and disappeared the next. If a member of his inner circle so much as hinted that someone was plotting against him, that person was never seen or heard of again. Stalin didn't believe in early retirement or a pension plan. He once told me that if you kill one person, you're a murderer. If you kill thousands, it becomes a mere statistic. Stalin boasted that his personal security protection was in a different class to anything the President of the United States was getting from the American Secret Service, and that wasn't hard to believe. When he left the Kremlin for his dacha each evening, and when he returned to the Kremlin the following morning, Vlasik was always by his side, ready to take an assassin's bullet, although the 9-kilometer route was permanently patrolled by 3,000 armed agents, and his bulletproof Zill limousine rarely travelled at less than 80 miles an hour. Harry was on page 79 of the manuscript when all passengers on the flight to London were requested to reboard the plane, by which time Stalin saw himself as something of a cross between Henry VIII and Catherine the Great. Harry walked up to the check-in counter.
"Would it be possible to change my flight to a later one?"
"Yes, of course, sir. We have one going via Amsterdam in 2 hours' time, but I'm afraid there's no connecting flight to London for another 4 hours."
"Perfect."
Chapter 46. Giles read William Warwick's signed confession on the front page of the Times the following morning and couldn't stop laughing. How could they have failed to notice that it wasn't Harry's signature? He could only assume that the Russians were in such a hurry to get the confession into the hands of the international press before he arrived back in England that they made a cock-up. It had happened often enough in the Foreign Office when Giles was a minister, but it rarely got beyond the press department. Mind you, when Churchill was visiting America just after the war, he asked the embassy to set up a meeting with the distinguished philosopher Isaiah Berlin and ended up having tea with Irving Berlin. Photographs of Harry dominated most of the morning papers, while leaders and opinion pieces about the popular author and his long-standing battle to have Anatoly Babakov released from prison filled many column inches on the inside pages. The cartoonists had a field day, depicting Harry as either George slaying the dragon or David felling Goliath. But Giles's favourite was one in the Daily Express of Harry fencing with a pen against a bear with a broken sword. The caption read, "Mightier than the sword." Giles was still laughing when he read William Warwick's confession for a second time. He assumed heads would be rolling, perhaps literally, in Russia.
"What's so funny?"
asked Emma, when she joined him for breakfast, still looking as if she could have done with a good night's sleep.
"Harry's done more to embarrass the Russians in one day than the Foreign Office could manage in a year. And there's even better news. Just look at the Telegraph's headline."
He held the paper up so she could read it. "William Warwick admits to being a spy."
"It's not a laughing matter," said Emma, pushing the papers aside. "If he'd still been in Russia when the first editions came out, it would have been a completely different headline."
"Well, at least look on the bright side."
"There's a bright side?"
"There most certainly is. Up until now, everyone's been asking why Harry wasn't in court supporting you. Well, now they all know, which is bound to make an impression on the jury."
"Except that Virginia was brilliant in the witness box. Far more convincing than I was."
"But I suspect the jury will have seen through her by now."
"Just in case you've forgotten, it took you a little longer."
Giles looked suitably chastened.
"I've just come off the phone with him," said Emma. "He's been held up in Stockholm. He seemed preoccupied and didn't say a great deal. He told me he's not expecting to land at Heathrow until around 5 this afternoon."
"Did he get his hands on Babakov's book?"
asked Giles.
"His money ran out before I had time to ask him," said Emma, as she poured herself some coffee. "In any case, I was more interested in trying to find out why it had taken him almost a week to do a journey that most other people manage in under 4 hours."
"And what was his explanation?"
"Didn't have one. Said he'd tell me everything as soon as he got home."
Emma took a sip of her coffee before adding,
"There's something he's not telling me that hasn't made the front pages."
"I bet it has something to do with Babakov's book."
"Damn that book," said Emma.
"What possessed him to take such a risk
when he'd already been threatened with a jail sentence?
Don't forget, this is the same man who took on a German division armed only with a pistol, a jeep, and an Irish corporal.
And he was lucky to survive that as well.
You knew what kind of man he was long before you married him. For better or worse,"
Giles said, taking his sister's hand.
"But does he begin to understand what he's put his family through during the last week? And just how lucky he is to have been put on a plane back to England, rather than on a train heading for Siberia, along with his friend Babakov?
I suspect there's a part of him that will have wanted to be on that train with Babakov," said Giles quietly. "That's why we both admire him so much."
"I'll never let him go abroad again," said Emma with feeling.
"Well, as long as he only heads west, it should still be all right," said Giles, trying to lighten the mood.
Emma bowed her head and suddenly burst into tears.
"You don't realize just how much you love someone until you think you might never see them again."
"I know how you feel," said Giles.
During the war, Harry had once stayed awake for 36 hours, but he was a lot younger then. One of the many subjects no one ever dared to raise with Stalin was the role he played during the siege of Moscow, when the outcome of the Second World War still hung in the balance. Did he, like most of the government ministers and their officials, beat a hasty retreat to Kubyshev on the Volga, or did he, as he claimed, refuse to leave the capital and remain in the Kremlin, personally organizing the defense of the city? His version became legend, part of the official Soviet history, although several people saw him on the platform moments before the train departed for Kubyshev, and there are no reliable reports of anyone seeing him in Moscow again until the Russian army had driven the enemy from the gates of the city. Few of those who expressed any doubts about Stalin's version lived to tell the tale. With a ballpoint pen in one hand and a slice of Edam cheese in the other, he carried on writing, page after page. He could hear Jessica remonstrating with him.
How can you sit in an airport lounge writing someone else's book when you're just a taxi ride away from the finest collection of Rembrandts, Vermeers, Steens and De Witts in the world?
Not a day went by when he didn't think of Jessica. He just hoped she'd understand why he had to temporarily replace Rembrandt with Babakov. Harry paused again to gather his thoughts.
Stalin always claimed that on the day of Nadia's funeral, he walked behind the coffin. In fact, he only did so for a few minutes because of an abiding fear of being assassinated. When the cortege reached the first inhabited buildings in Manej Square, he disappeared into the back of a car, while his brother-in-law, Alyosha Svanitsa, also a short, stocky man with a thick black moustache, took his place. Svanitsa wore Stalin's greatcoat, so the crowd would assume he must be the grieving widower.
Would all passengers?
Mrs. Justice Lane released everyone from court number 14 at 4 o'clock that afternoon, but not until she was convinced that the jury wouldn't be able to reach a verdict that evening.
I'm off to Heathrow, said Emma, looking at her watch. With a bit of luck, I'll be just in time to meet Harry off the plane.
Would you like us to come with you?
Asked Giles.
Certainly not. I want him all to myself for the first few hours, but I'll bring him back to Smith Square this evening, and we can all have dinner together.
Taxi drivers always smile when a fare says Heathrow. Emma climbed into the back of the cab, confident she could be at the airport before the plane landed. The first thing she did on entering the terminal building was to check the arrivals board. Little numbers and letters flicked over every few moments, supplying the latest information for each flight. The board indicated that passengers arriving from Amsterdam on BOAC 786 were now in baggage reclaim. But then she remembered that Harry had only taken a small overnight bag, as he hadn't planned to be in Leningrad for more than a few hours, one night at the most. In any case, he was always among the first off the plane, as he liked to be speeding down the motorway on his way back to Bristol before the last passengers had cleared customs. Made him feel he'd stolen time. Could she have missed him, she wondered, as several passengers passed her, with bags displaying Amsterdam luggage tags. She was about to go in search of a telephone and call Giles when Harry finally appeared.
I'm so sorry, he said,
throwing his arms around her.
I had no idea you'd be waiting for me. I thought you'd still be in court.
The judge let us go at 4 because it didn't look as if the jury were going to reach a verdict today.
Harry released her and said,
Can I make the strangest request? Anything, my darling. Could we book into an airport hotel for a couple of hours?
We haven't done that for some time, said Emma, grinning.
I'll explain why later, said Harry.
He didn't speak again until he'd signed the hotel register and they checked into their room. Emma lay on the bed, watching as Harry sat at a little desk by the window, writing as if his life depended on it. She wasn't allowed to speak, turn on the television, or even order room service, so, in desperation, she picked up the first chapter of what she assumed must be the latest William Warwick novel. She was hooked from the first sentence. When Harry finally put down his pen, 3.5 hours later, and slumped onto the bed beside her, all she said was,
Don't say a word. Just hand me the next chapter.
Whenever I was required at the dacha, not that often, I always ate in the kitchen. A real treat because Stalin's chef, Spiridon Ivanovich Putin, would give me and the three tasters exactly the same food as was being served to Stalin and his guests in the dining room. That should hardly come as a surprise. The three tasters were just another example of Stalin's paranoia and his belief that someone must be trying to poison him. They would sit silently at the kitchen table, never opening their mouths except to eat. Chef Putin's conversation was also limited, as he assumed that anyone who entered his domain, kitchen staff, waiters, guards, tasters, was almost certainly a spy, me included.
When he did speak, which was never before the meal had been cleared away and the last guest had left the dining room, it would only ever be about his family, of whom he was inordinately proud, particularly his most recent grandson, Vladimir. Once the guests had all departed, Stalin would retreat to his study and read until the early hours. A portrait of Lenin hung above his desk, a lamp illuminating his face. He loved reading Russian novels, often scribbling comments in the margins. If he couldn't get to sleep, he would slip out into the garden, prune his roses, and admire the peacocks that wandered through the grounds. When he finally returned to the house, he didn't decide which room he would sleep in until the last moment. Unable to shake off past memories of being a young revolutionary, always on the move, never certain where he was going to rest. He would then grab a few hours' sleep on a sofa, the door locked, and his guards outside, who would never unlock the door until he called. Stalin rarely rose before midday, when, after a light lunch, no drink, he would be driven from his dacha to the Kremlin in a convoy, but never in the same car. When he arrived, he immediately set to work with his six secretaries. I never once saw him yawn. Emma turned the page, while Harry fell into a deep sleep. When he woke just after midnight, she had reached chapter 12, the opening paragraph of which was on the back of a first-class menu. She gathered up several sheets of paper and put them as neatly as she could into Harry's overnight bag, then helped him off the bed, guided him out of the room and into the nearest lift. Once Emma had paid the bill, she asked the bellboy to hail her a taxi. He opened the back door and allowed the tired old man and his girlfriend to climb inside.
"Where to, miss?"
asked the cabbie.
23 Smith Square.
During the journey back into London, Emma brought Harry up to date about what had been happening in the trial, Fisher's death and Giles's preparations for the by-election, Virginia's performance in the witness box, and the letter from Fisher that Mr. Trelford had received that morning.
"What did it say?"
asked Harry.
"I don't know, and I'm not sure I even want to know. But it might help you win the case. That doesn't seem likely if Fisher's involved." "And I've only been away just over a week," said Harry, as the taxi drew up outside Giles's home in Smith Square.
When the front doorbell rang, Giles quickly answered it, to find his closest friend holding on to his sister with one hand and the railing with the other, to make sure he didn't fall over. His two new guards took an arm each and guided him into the house, past the dining room and up the stairs to the guest bedroom on the first floor. He didn't reply when Giles said,
"Sleep well, old chum,"
and closed the door behind him. By the time Emma had undressed her husband and hung up his suit, she became painfully aware what the inside of a Russian prison cell must smell like. But he was already sound asleep by the time she pulled off his socks. She crept into the bed beside him, and although she knew he couldn't hear her, she whispered firmly,
"The furthest east I will allow you to travel in future will be Cambridge."
She then switched on the bedside light and continued to read Uncle Joe. It was another hour before she finally discovered why the Russians had gone to such lengths to make sure that no one ever got their hands on the book. Comrade Stalin's 70th birthday was celebrated across the Soviet Empire in a manner that would have impressed a Caesar. No one who hoped to live talked of his retirement. Young men feared early preferment because it often heralded early retirement, and as Stalin seemed determined to hold on to power, any suggestion of mortality meant your funeral, not his. While I sat at the back of the endless meetings celebrating Stalin's achievements, I began to form my own plans for a tiny slice of immortality, the publication of my unauthorized biography. But I would have to wait, possibly for years after Stalin's death, for the right moment to present itself, before I approached a publisher, a brave publisher, who would be willing to consider taking on Uncle Joe. What I hadn't anticipated was just how long Stalin would cling on. and he certainly had no intention of releasing the reins of power before the pallbearers had lowered him into the ground, and more than one or two of his enemies remained silent for several days after his death, just in case he rose again. A great deal has been written about Stalin's death. The official communiqué, which I translated for the international press, claimed that he died at his desk in the Kremlin after suffering a stroke, and that was the accepted version for many years. Whereas in truth, he was staying at his dacha, and after a drunken dinner with his inner circle, which included Lavrenty Beria, his deputy premier and former secret police chief, Nikita Khrushchev and Georgi Malenkov, he retired to bed, but not before all his guests had left the dacha. Beria, Malenkov and Khrushchev all feared for their lives, because they knew Stalin planned to replace them with younger, more loyal lieutenants. After all, that was exactly how each of them had got his own job in the first place. The following day, Stalin still hadn't risen by late afternoon, and one of his guards, worried that he might be ill, phoned Beria, who dismissed the man's fears and told him Stalin was probably just sleeping off a hangover. Another hour passed before the guard called Beria again. This time he summoned Khrushchev and Malenkov, and they immediately drove over to the dacha. Beria gave the order to unlock the door of the room in which Stalin had spent the night, and the three of them tentatively entered, to find him lying on the floor, unconscious but still breathing. Khrushchev bent down to check his pulse, when suddenly a muscle twitched. Stalin stared up at Beria and grabbed him by the arm. Khrushchev fell on his knees, placed his hands around Stalin's throat, and strangled him. Stalin struggled for a few minutes, while Beria and Malenkov held him down. Once they were convinced he was dead, they left the room, locking the door behind them. Beria immediately issued an order that all of Stalin's personal guards, 16 of them, were to be shot, so there could be no witnesses to what had happened. No one was informed of Stalin's death until the official announcement was made several hours later, the one I translated, which claimed he died of a stroke while working at his desk in the Kremlin. In fact, he was strangled by Khrushchev and left lying in a pool of his own urine for several hours before his body was removed from the dacha. For the next 14 days, Stalin's body lay in state in the Hall of Columns, dressed in full military uniform, wearing his Hero of the Soviet Union and Hero of Socialist Labour medals. Beria, Malenkov and Khrushchev, heads bowed, stood in respectful silence beside the embalmed corpse of their former leader. These three men were to become the troika who grabbed power in his place, although Stalin hadn't considered any of them worthy to succeed him, and they knew it. Khrushchev, thought of as no more than a peasant, became secretary of the party. Malenkov, whom Stalin once described as an obese, spineless pen-pusher, was appointed prime minister, while the ruthless Beria, whom Stalin regarded as a sordid sex addict, took control of the nation's security services. A few months later, in June 1953, Khrushchev had Beria arrested and later, not much later, executed for treason. Within a year, he had removed Malenkov and appointed himself prime minister as well as supreme leader. He only spared Malenkov's life once he agreed to announce publicly that it was Beria who had murdered Stalin. Emma fell asleep. Chapter 47. When Emma woke the following morning, she found Harry kneeling on the floor, trying to sort out various different bits of paper and arrange them in neat piles. BOAC writing paper, the backs of a dozen first-class menus, and even lavatory paper. She joined him, concentrating on the lavatory paper. 40 minutes later, they had a book.
"What time do we have to be in court?"
asked Harry, as they made their way downstairs to join Giles and Seb for breakfast.
10, in theory, said Emma, but Mr. Trelford doesn't think the jury will return much before midday.
Breakfast was the first real meal Harry had eaten for the best part of a week, but despite that, He was surprised how little he could manage. They sat in silence as he regaled them with everything he'd experienced since they'd last seen him. They were introduced to the taxi driver, the old woman in the bookshop, the KGB colonel, the tribunal chairman, the chief prosecutor, the defense attorney, the jury, and, finally, Anatoly Babakov, whom he'd liked and admired. He told them how that truly remarkable man had spent every hour he could stay awake telling Harry his story.
"Won't he be in considerable danger if the book is published?" suggested Giles. "The answer must be yes. But he was adamant that Uncle Joe be published before he died, because it would allow his wife to live in comfort for the rest of her life. So once the trial is over, I plan to fly back to the States and hand over the manuscript to Harold Ginsberg. I'll then travel on to Pittsburgh to see Yelena Babakov and pass on several messages from her husband," he added, as Big Ben struck the first of 10 chimes.
"It can't be that late," said Emma, leaping up from the table. "Seb, go and find a cab while your father and I get ready."
Seb smiled. He wondered when mothers stopped treating their children as if they were perpetually 15-year-olds. 10 minutes later, they were all heading up Whitehall towards the Strand.
"Are you looking forward to being back in the house?"
asked Harry as they drove past Downing Street.
"I haven't even been selected as the candidate yet," said Giles. "Well, at least this time Alex Fisher won't cause you any trouble."
"I wouldn't be so sure of that," said Giles.
"You must be a shoo-in," said Emma.
"In politics, there are no shoo-ins," Giles assured her, as they drew up outside the law courts. The cameras began flashing even before Emma had stepped out of the cab. She and Harry walked arm in arm through the phalanx of journalists and photographers, most of whom seemed more interested in her husband than in the defendant.
"Are you relieved to be back home, sir?" shouted one of them. "Is London colder than Siberia?"
quipped another.
"Is it good to have him back, Mrs. Clifton?"
yelled a third. Emma broke Giles's golden rule.
"Yes, it most certainly is," she said, as she squeezed Harry's hand.
"Do you think you'll win today?"
persisted another, which she pretended not to hear. Seb was waiting for them and held open the massive door to allow them through.
"Are you hoping to be the Labour candidate in the Bristol by-election, Sir Giles?"
But Giles simply waved and smiled, giving them a picture, but no words, before he disappeared into the building. The four of them made their way up the wide marble staircase to find Mr. Trelford occupying his favourite corner bench on the first floor. Trelford stood the moment he saw Emma approaching. She introduced him to Harry.
"Good morning, Detective Inspector Warwick," said Trelford. "I've been looking forward to meeting you."
Harry shook the barrister warmly by the hand.
"I must apologise for not being here sooner, but I have..."
"I know," said Trelford, "and I can't wait to read it."
The tannoy crackled.
"Would all those involved in the Lady Virginia Fenwick versus..."
"The jury must have reached a decision," Trelford said, already on the move.
He looked round to check that they were all following him, and bumped into someone. He apologised, but the young man didn't look back. Sebastian, who had walked on ahead, held open the door to court number 14 so his mother and her silk could resume their places in the front row. Emma was too nervous to speak, and fearing the worst, kept glancing anxiously over her shoulder at Harry, who sat in the row behind her as they waited for the jury to appear. When Mrs. Justice Lane entered the courtroom, everyone rose. She bowed before resuming her place. Emma transferred her attention to the closed door beside the jury box. She didn't have to wait long before it swung open, and the bailiff reappeared, followed by his 12 disciples. They took their time finding their places, treading on each other's toes like late-arriving theatre-goers. The bailiff waited for them to settle, before he banged his rod 3 times on the floor and shouted,
"Will the foreman please rise?"
The foreman rose to his full 5 feet 4 inches and looked up at the judge. Mrs. Justice Lane leant forward and said,
"Have you reached a verdict on which you are all agreed?"
Emma thought her heart would stop beating, as she waited for his reply.
No, my lady. Then have you reached a verdict on which you are agreed by a majority of at least 10-2?
We did, my lady, said the foreman. But unfortunately, at the last moment, one of our number changed his mind, and we have been stuck on 9-3 for the past hour. I am not convinced that will change, so once again, I am seeking your guidance as to what we should do next. Do you believe you could reach a majority of 10-2 if I gave you a little more time?
I do, my lady, because on one particular matter, all 12 of us are in agreement.
And what is that?
If we were allowed to know the contents of the letter Major Fisher wrote to Mr. Trelford, we might well be able to come to a decision fairly quickly.
Everybody's eyes were fixed on the judge, except for Sir Edward Makepeace, who was looking closely at Trelford. Either he was a formidable poker player, or he didn't want the jury to know what was in that letter. Trelford rose from his seat and reached into his inside pocket, only to find that the letter was no longer there. He looked across to the far side of the court to see that Lady Virginia was smiling. He returned her smile. We hope you've enjoyed Mightier Than the Sword, a Macmillan Audio and Macmillan Digital Audio production from Pan Macmillan, a division of Macmillan Publishers Limited. Text copyright 2015 by Geoffrey Archer. Production copyright 2015 by Macmillan Digital Audio. All rights reserved. Produced by Mary Price and edited by Jake Whitlin at Strathmore Publishing for Macmillan Digital Audio. Another man, now safely back in cabin class, was also wide awake. Although it was 3 a.m. and his job was done, he wasn't trying to sleep. He was just about to go to work. Always the same anxieties whenever you have to wait. Had you left any clues that would lead straight to you? Had you made any mistakes that will cause the operation to end in failure and make you a laughingstock back home? He wouldn't relax until he was on a lifeboat, and better still, on another ship, heading towards another port. 5:14. He knew his compatriots, soldiers in the same cause, would be just as nervous as he was. The waiting was always the worst part. Out of your control, no longer anything you could do. 4:11. Worse than a football match when you're 1-0 up, but you know the other side are stronger and well capable of scoring in injury time. He recalled his area commander's instructions. When the alarm goes off, be sure you're among the first on deck and the first in the lifeboats, because by this time tomorrow, they'll be searching for anyone under the age of 35 with an Irish accent. So keep your mouths shut, boys. 3:40. 39. He stared at the cabin door and imagined the worst that could possibly happen. The bomb wouldn't go off. The door would burst open, and a dozen police thugs, possibly more, would come charging in, batons flailing in every direction, not caring how many times they hit him. But all he could hear was the rhythmical pounding of the engine as the Buckingham continued its sedate passage across the Atlantic on its way to New York, a city it would never reach. 2:34. 33. He began to imagine what it would be like once he was back on the Falls Road. Young lads in short trousers would look up in awe as he passed them on the street, their only ambition to be like him when they grew up. The hero who had blown up the Buckingham only a few weeks after it had been named by the Queen Mother. No mention of innocent lives lost. There are no innocent lives when you believe in a cause. In fact, he'd never meet any of the passengers in the cabins on the upper decks. He would read all about them in tomorrow's papers, and if he'd done his job properly, there would be no mention of his name. 1:22. 21. What could possibly go wrong now? Would the device constructed in an upstairs bedroom on the Dungannon estate let him down at the last minute? Was he about to suffer the silence of failure?